content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the February 27th, 2015 issue of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. Putin raises the stakes in Ukraine. What happened? A ceasefire between Ukraine and Russian-backed rebels essentially ended before it began this week, as the separatists mounted a fierce offensive that forced government troops to withdraw from the strategically important railway hub of Debaltseve. The ceasefire deal, negotiated in Minsk last week by the leaders of Ukraine, Russia, Germany, and France, did not stop rebels backed by Russian troops and armor from overwhelming government forces in Debaltseve. Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko called the ceasefire violation a cynical attack on the Minsk agreements and called on the world to stop the aggressor, Russian President Vladimir Putin. Putin insisted that the separatists were receiving no help from the Russian troops and arms and mocked Ukraine's army. It's always a hardship when you lose to yesterday's miners or yesterday's tractor drivers, said the Russian leader. But life is life. It will surely go on. In response to calls in Kiev and Washington for the U.S. to supply heavy armor to Ukraine, Russia's foreign minister warned that such aid would be perceived as a direct threat to Russia itself. Russia's state media told Russians to prepare for an escalation of hostilities. Russia and the U.S. are on the verge of a nuclear war, a government-run website stated. What the editorial said. Mr. Putin won a lot in Minsk, said the New York Times. The deal consolidates the rebels' substantial territorial gains since the last ceasefire in September. And the only significant concession to Kiev, control over its border with Russia, is conditional on constitutional charges and local elections that would give rebel-held regions considerable autonomy. While this must have been a bitter pill for Poroshenko, he had no choice but to swallow it. Ukraine's debt and inflation-ridden economy is sinking, and it will never recover without a respite from the conflict. Putin is playing Western leaders for fools, said the Wall Street Journal. This hollow ceasefire legitimizes his military gains in eastern Ukraine and gives President Obama another excuse not to supply Ukraine's demoralized and ill-equipped military with weapons that can measure up to the Russians. The West's desperation to secure a second ceasefire just 5 months after Putin's separatist puppets ignored the first one tells him that future violations will carry no real price. What the columnist said. Putin's aggression in Ukraine is part of a broader and more dangerous confrontation with the West, said the economist. Increasingly threatened by what he sees as an expansionist EU and NATO, the Russian president has almost tripled defense spending since 2007, ordering a huge modernization of his armed forces and nuclear arsenal. That has coincided with a pattern of provocation, from ostentatious military exercises on Russia's borders to incursions into foreign airspace in Britain, Sweden, and other countries. Ominously, Putin has taken to reminding people that Russia has a nuclear arsenal of more than 8,000 warheads, and Putin's chief propagandist recently warned that whereas the Soviet Union ruled out first use of nuclear weapons, modern Russian doctrine does not. The U.S. should call Putin's bluff and provide arms to the Ukrainians, said James Jeffrey in foreignpolicy.com. Heavy weapons would give a battlefield edge to the Ukrainian army and would send a clear signal to Moscow that we have bent and acquiesced for long enough. Actually, a get-tough strategy would stoke the fires of Russian nationalism and could lead to a dangerous escalation, said Fareed Zakaria in the Washington Post. It's far wiser to keep patiently targeting the Russian economy, which is being torn apart by existing sanctions and plummeting oil prices. Over time, the money will run out. What Putin fears most isn't Western tanks or sanction. It's a thriving, prosperous Ukraine, said Fred Kaplan in Slate.com. That would show Russia and the rest of the former Soviet republics that a better, richer life can be had under Western styles of governance. We shouldn't limit ourselves to sanctions. We should also flood Kiev with financial aid and investment. What won the Cold War can win this competition, too. Patience, endurance, shrewd containment, and the example of something better just across the horizon. We'll take in a second main story this week. ISIS threat expands to Libya. What happened? Egyptian warplanes bombed an Islamist stronghold in Libya this week in retaliation for the beheading of 21 Egyptian Christians by a local affiliate of the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, opening a new front in the battle against the fast-growing jihadist group. The strikes came hours after ISIS released a gruesome video showing masked militants marching the Coptic men, many of whom had gone to Libya to work as laborers, onto a beach before sawing their heads off with knives. "Safety for you crusaders is something you can only wish for," said one militant in the video. "We will conquer Rome by the will of Allah." Egypt responded with two waves of dawn airstrikes, bombing what is said were training camps and weapons caches belonging to ISIS Libyan offshoot, killing at least 40 militants. Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi called for an international coalition to intervene in war-torn Libya, which has been ruled by a patchwork of militias since NATO-backed rebels toppled dictator Muammar al-Qaddafi in 2011. The bloody emergence of ISIS's Libyan affiliate came as jihadist outfits in Afghanistan, Algeria, and Egypt also pledged allegiance to the group. Factions that were at one time part of al-Qaeda and its affiliates, said Stephen Stalinsky, a Washington-based Middle East expert, have moved on to what they see as more of a winning group. What the editorial said: "The West has itself to blame for the bloodshed in Libya," said the Washington Post. "NATO countries simply walked away after they helped topple Qaddafi, leaving rival Libyan militias to fight for power. Libya is now divided between two warring governments, parliaments, and armies with rival foreign sponsors. In the East is a Western-endorsed secular government backed by Egypt and the United Arab Emirates. In the West, in the capital Tripoli, is a rival alliance of Islamists supported by Turkey and Qatar. In the space between them flourish extremists." A foreign military intervention won't restore order, said BloombergView.com. The arrival of Western or even Egyptian troops on the shores of Tripoli would be used as a recruiting tool by ISIS, bolstering its claims that it's defending Islam from crusaders and U.S. allied apostates. The West and Arab worlds should instead focus on forcing Libya's two warring factions to resume UN-sponsored peace talks and forge a national unity government. Whether in Libya, Syria, or Iraq, ISIS thrives in the fissures of civil war. Healing those divisions offers the best hope of staunching its spread. What the columnist said: "Europeans are justifiably panicked by the appearance of ISIS on their doorstep," said Barbie Latsa Nadu in the DailyBeast.com. Libya sits at the heart of a massive people smuggling operation, and in one recent weekend, 2,164 migrants left its shores on boats bound for Sicily, just 300 miles across the Mediterranean. It would take little for jihadi fighters to infiltrate a migrant boat and effectively end up taxied into Italy by rescue ships. This chaos is a consequence of President Obama's decision to lead from behind, said Jennifer Rubin in WashingtonPost.com. Declaring that the U.S. wasn't the world's policeman, he chose not to arm or advise moderate Libyans after Gaddafi's fall. And just like in Yemen, Iraq, and Syria, all failing states that Obama neglected to buttress, violent jihadists quickly stepped into the power vacuum. Obama failed to snuff out the embers while they were containable, and now the Islamist fire is raging out of control. To defeat ISIS, we first need to stop thinking of it as a terrorist organization, said Audrey Kurth Cronin in Foreign Affairs. Unlike traditional terrorist networks, which typically have only a few hundred members and don't hold territory, ISIS boasts some 30,000 fighters and grabs territory wherever it can. The targeted airstrikes, special operations raids, and de-radicalization programs we used to roll back al-Qaeda won't work against what is essentially a pseudo-state led by a conventional army. We should treat ISIS as a bad state actor, like North Korea, and police its borders and wear it down with economic sanctions and military raids. Unless we want to embark on a full-fledged war with ISIS in North America, North Africa, and the Middle East, containment is the best policy the U.S. can pursue. Speaking of ISIS, our controversy of the week is fighting ISIS, Obama's request for new war powers. You can't be a little bit pregnant, said W. James Antle III in the AmericanConservative.com. But Barack Obama seems to think you can just be a little bit at war. 6 months after first launching airstrikes against Islamic State in Iraq and Syria fighters, President Obama finally asked Congress last week for an authorization for use of military force. The draft authorization he sent Congress is a characteristically ambivalent document, explicitly ruling out enduring offensive ground operations and calling for the authorization itself to expire or sunset in 3 years, regardless of whether ISIS has been defeated. Obama's AUMF is a classic muddle, said Max Boot in CommentaryMagazine.com. Faced with the stark and gathering threat posed by ISIS's medieval mass murderers, our risk-averse president produced a split-the-difference solution that's as concerned with appeasing the anti-war left as it is with defeating the enemy. Don't be fooled, said Greg Sargent in WashingtonPost.com. If approved, Obama's AUMF would leave Obama with enormous war-making latitude. He's asking Congress to authorize military action not only against ISIS, but against all associated persons or forces with no geographic restrictions at all. And Special Forces soldiers would be allowed to make targeted strikes on the ground. As for the three-year sunset provision, it's essentially meaningless, said Bruce Ackerman in the New York Times. Throughout his presidency, Obama has used a broad interpretation of the AUMF that Congress gave President Bush in 2001 after the 9/11 attacks to launch drone strikes and other military action around the world at will. If Congress approves this new AUMF without repealing the old one, it will, in effect, be a ringing endorsement of unlimited presidential war-making. The president knows he doesn't need new authorization, said Matthew Continetti in NationalReview.com. This is all about political cover for Obama. By seeking Congress's approval for a war on ISIS with urgency and drama, He's hoping the public won't notice that so far the war in question has amounted to an ineffective and rather desultory campaign of airstrikes, and a mere 2,600 troops sent to Iraq to act as advisors. The truth is that ISIS cannot be defeated without a massive ratcheting up of the air campaign and a significant deployment of ground troops. Why should Republicans fall into the trap of sanctioning a flawed strategy? Congress should reject his request, making it clear to the voters before the 2016 election that Democrats are unserious and untrustworthy about fighting Islamic extremism, and that Republicans offer a robust and muscular alternative. When Republicans are done with their theatrical criticism of Obama's campaign against ISIS, said Fred Kaplan in Slate.com, they'll give the president what he wants. In recent decades, presidents have effectively expanded their ability to wage undeclared war, and both the courts and Congress have shied away from stopping them. That was even true in 2006, when Democrats won control of Congress but still failed to interfere with an unpopular war in Iraq. Legislators like to criticize the president's war decisions, but they don't want the responsibility or, more to the point, blame if all hell breaks loose as a result of their saying no. Obama really can't lose here, said Josh Rogan in BloombergView.com. If he gets his AUMF, he's a wartime president with bipartisan support. If he doesn't, he can just carry on waging war as he sees fit, using the 2001 AUMF as legal cover. Congress, meanwhile, will have ensured its own irrelevance. Well, it was a good week for truth in advertising. After a tourism site for Ithaca in upstate New York, suffering through a prolonged below-zero cold snap, declared, "Winter, you win," and recommended that visitors take a trip to the Florida Keys instead. It was a good week for show-offs after Montana lawmakers rejected a proposal to ban tight-fitting garments such as yoga pants that give the appearance of a person's buttocks, genitals, or nipples. Yoga pants should be illegal in public, said Representative David Moore. And it was a good week for a little confidence after a British poet announced the first ever big small penis party to celebrate wee willies, combat body shaming, and give men with smaller endowments a needed boost of self-confidence. It was a bad week for beating the house after a New Jersey judge ordered a group of gamblers to return $1.5 million in winnings to an Atlantic City casino because they knew the cards weren't pre-shuffled in accordance with regulation and increased their bets. It was a bad week for failing to respect dibs after a Boston Uber car driver got revenge on a motorist who stole his shoveled-out parking spot by putting the snow back, burying the offending vehicle. And it was a bad week for the VP treatment after Vice President Joe Biden put his nose in the neck and hair of Stephanie Carter, touched her shoulders, and whispered intimately into her ear as her husband, Ashton, was sworn in as Secretary of Defense. One Twitter wag called Biden America's creepy uncle. Turn now to the briefing page. California's high-speed gamble. Work on the costliest public works project in U.S. history is underway. But will the bullet train ever leave the station? What will the bullet train do? If it's ever completed, the train will whisk passengers at 220 miles per hour from Los Angeles to San Francisco in 2 hours and 40 minutes. Half the usual 6-hour car journey. That futuristic vision convinced California voters to approve a 2008 referendum authorizing a $10 billion bond package to help finance the train's construction by 2029. The original projected cost was $33 billion, but from day one, the mammoth project has been plagued by lawsuits, land disputes, and budget overruns. Work finally got underway on the first $1 billion 29-mile Central Valley stretch of the 520-mile track in January, 2 years behind schedule. But with the projected cost swelling to $68 billion, the most expensive public works project in U.S. history, and Republicans determined to derail the project, many wonder whether the bullet train will ever become a reality. The project is about to enter a tunnel of uncertainty, said political professor Jack Pitney. We don't know what's on the other side. Why build this railway? The U.S. lags far behind Europe and Asia in high-speed rail transportation, and the bullet train was promoted by California Governor Jerry Brown and President Obama as a way to drag American mass transit into the 21st century. California seemed an ideal fit for the project. The state is renowned for its traffic-choked freeways, and congestion is only going to get worse as California's population balloons to an estimated 50 million people by 2050. Then there are the economic benefits of the railway, which will eventually be extended from San Diego to Sacramento. Supporters say that the 24 stations along the route will enable people in the middle of the state to commute to big city jobs now beyond their reach, leading to the creation of 450,000 permanent jobs. But that presupposes that the bullet train ever makes it onto the tracks. What's stopping it? First, there's the question of land. The railway won't travel along California's heavily developed coast, but instead will cut a weaving pathway inland to the east, through the Central Valley. So far, California officials have acquired only 101 of the needed 526 parcels of territory needed to construct the first 29-mile Central Valley section of the railroad. They've been hindered by multiple lawsuits from farmers, residents who live near the projected path, and environmentalists worried about the carbon cost of such a gargantuan construction project. But supporters say the bullet train would ultimately produce a steep cut in the number of carbon-intensive car and air journeys between the two cities. What about funding? That's the biggest problem. In 2014, the California legislature agreed to funnel 25% of future cap-and-trade revenues collected through the state carbon emissions regulations to the project, or about $1 billion annually. But combining those funds with a $3.3 billion federal stimulus package and the $10 billion bond measure would still provide only $26 billion, under half the estimated total cost. Rail officials are counting on private investors to fund a third of the project, as they did in Japan. But Republicans, who have vowed to block further public funding, remain skeptical the tracks will ever extend beyond the Central Valley. It's hard to celebrate breaking ground on what is likely to become abandoned pieces of track, says U.S. Representative Jeff Denham, a Republican. Why are the opponents so skeptical? Critics say the project will undoubtedly cost even more than currently estimated and run into the countless unforeseen problems. State Senator Mark Desaulnier, a Democrat, said he supports high-speed rail in theory, but when you get into the details, I just don't think people have put enough effort into the details. Other former bullet train supporters say the original ballot measure promised a train that would zip passengers from downtown Los Angeles to downtown San Francisco, when in reality the journey will begin and end on slower, already existing tracks in both cities before hitting top speed out in the valley. But High Speed Rail Authority head Dan Richards still claims that the trip will total less than 3 hours, with no transfers. The voters are going to get exactly what they asked for. Will the train get built? It could go either way. As skepticism has grown, critics are trying to put a new referendum on the ballot to cancel the bullet train, So far, they haven't gotten the necessary 500,000 signatures. But the project could be about to take on an unstoppable momentum. Thanks to a quirk in federal funding requirements, California will need to spend at least $4 billion on the railway by October 1, 2017, $3 million to $4 million every calendar day for the next 1,000 days. Before, you never knew if we were going to if and when the project would really get going, said political scientist Larry Gertson. Now, as those tracks get laid mile by mile, it gets harder and harder to turn back. Musk's high-speed alternative. For some transport visionaries, high-speed rail isn't futuristic enough. Why plow billions of dollars into a bullet train that will already be outdated by 2030, they argue, when California could instead invest in genuinely cutting-edge transportation projects? The most revolutionary proposal to replace the bullet train is undoubtedly the Hyperloop. The brainchild of inventor and Tesla CEO Elon Musk, the Hyperloop would zip passengers in capsules through a vacuum tube from San Francisco to Los Angeles at staggering speeds up to 760 miles per hour in just a half hour. The billionaire is so convinced his high-speed pods are the vehicles of the future that he's now building a test track in Texas and raising funding for further research. He says the Hyperloop could be built for $6 billion to $10 billion, a fraction of the bullet train's cost. You could have about 70 pods between Los Angeles and San Francisco that leave every 30 seconds, said Musk. It's like getting a ride on Space Mountain at Disneyland. We turn now to the columns. Take two from the U.S. The first from Dara Lind at Vox.com. Dismantle Homeland Security. The Department of Homeland Security is a total disaster, said Dara Lind. The current partisan battle over temporarily defunding the department to block President Obama's new immigration policy has obscured an even more important question. Why does the department even exist? Created in the panicked wake of the 9/11 attacks, the mammoth department absorbed dozens of other agencies in a theoretical effort to coordinate intelligence gathering and security. But the DHS did not absorb either the FBI or the CIA. And now three agencies are handling the country's counterterrorism work. Much of what DHS does duplicates the work of the Justice Department and Defense Department, leading to frequent turf wars, even within the department. There is constant infighting among its 240,000 employees, resulting in the lowest morale among all large agencies. It's no coincidence that the Secret Service became a national joke after it was moved from the Department of the Treasury to DHS. Let's undo a giant mistake, dismantle DHS, and return critical agencies to other departments. All we'll lose is a massive and counterproductive layer of bureaucracy. From David Harsanyi at TheFederalist.com, Democrats also punt on science. On a trip to London last week, Republican Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker was asked, "Do you believe in evolution?" Walker's defensive response, quote, "I'm going to punt on that one," unquote, was met with an eruption of scorn among liberals, who seized on it as proof once again that all Republicans are slack-jawed yokels who think Moses had ridden atop a Tyrannosaurus Rex to receive the Ten Commandments. But Democrats who supposedly revere science are rarely asked discomforting questions that challenge their secular faith. And when they punt, they get away with it. All Democrats should be asked, as Barack Obama famously said it was, and when they punt, they get away with it. All Democrats should be asked, is a 20-week-old unborn child a human being? When asked this question, Barack Obama famously said it was above his pay grade to decide, though his policies promote unlimited abortion. And how about, is nuclear power the safest energy in the world? Democrats say no, but 70% of scientists want more nuclear plants built because it clearly is. Do you believe genetically modified organisms are safe to eat? Again, scientists say yes, but liberals say no. It is not only religious conservatives who are sometimes uncomfortable with science. In this column from Lebanon, Yazin al-Sadi at the publication Al-Akbar English, a terrorist attack gets whitewashed. To Americans, you can't be a terrorist if you're not Muslim, said Yazan al-Saidi. The reaction to the slaying of three Muslim students in North Carolina tells us all we need to know about the massive system of harassment, vilification, and abuse directed toward Arabs and Muslims in the United States. Alleged shooter Craig Hicks, a white atheist, had a history of anti-Islam and anti-religious statements. Yet the U.S. media are parroting the police story that he was motivated by a parking dispute. That's like saying that the Charlie Hebdo attackers killed people because of artistic differences. Everyone knows that if a U.S. Muslim had executed three white atheists, it would have automatically resulted in the ubiquitous use of the word terror in every headline from New York City to Los Angeles. But then, what should we expect from the country that made American Sniper, a film based on the life of a bigoted liar who relished killing Arabs, into the top-grossing entertainment of the month? This is the same country that incinerated to a crisp a 13-year-old Yemeni boy in a drone strike last month. In American mythology and reality, the only good Arab or Muslim is either dead or blindly submissive. Turn now to the last word. 13,000-year-old masterpieces. In France's New Caves, said an art critic, Jerry Saltz, the prehistoric paintings rival the best works at the Louvre. And Niu is spelled N-I-A-U-X. In 2008, my wife and I spent a week driving through the stunning Spanish Pyrenees looking at small Romanesque churches, often alone with no tourists around. I knew there were Paleolithic caves nearby in France, so before we left New York, I booked a time slot for a group tour inside the Niu Caves. We crossed the Pyrenees, and after being horrified by hordes of European shoppers, who come daily to Andorra for tax-free goods, we passed into a chasm that became a deep mountain gorge. The Niu Caves are located at the southern mouth of this valley. I imagine that even 13,000 years ago, this would have been a place with a constant source of fresh water, an abundance of raw materials, fish game, a perch from which to observe herds and watch for invaders, and a view to die for. We parked in a large lot. Scads of European families and Americans with fanny packs and kids were all around. Soon about 15 of us met in a pre-designated spot near the entrance to the caves. We were greeted by our guide, a 20-something art historian from Paris. She handed each of us a small flashlight and explained that these would be the only source of light on our trip inside the caves, and that we were to stick together in a single-file line until we got to the gallery. Ducking low through a small opening in the stone, we passed into darkness. The cave's original, much larger entrance had been elsewhere and, along with an enormous overhang, had collapsed millennia ago, sometime after the last ice age. Presumably, these caves were originally not entirely dark, as light was able to flood in. In any event, it's thought that this entry opened sometime around 1600. My wife and I stuck close to the guide as she lectured. Already something was happening to me. I loved being in this subterranean world, feeling the atmospheric pressures change, noticing the sounds of the world fading, new humidities, air currents, and sounds appearing, seeing walls undulate. I felt grateful to be here and very close to my wife and to our guide. I wasn't afraid to be here, but I was aware that I was not only in an alien world, but something alien inside me was awakening, and my senses were sharpening in strange ways. After walking for a while, feeling my interior world intensify, we stopped. Our guide said, "Please gather around me. We are about to enter the gallery. Stick together. Do not touch anything or leave the path. Please hand me all of your flashlights. I will have the only light in the gallery." I had an instant of wanting to hide my flashlight so as to use it to see better. As I handed my light to her, I sensed she knew that this moment produced apprehension, and she smiled at each of us reassuringly. Like two kids, my wife and I huddled on either side of the guide, walking another 200 feet in total silence until we came to what felt like a large, irregularly shaped cavern. I can still feel cool currents on my face. We were in the Salon Noir. Everything remained silent. Our guide pointed her light to the ground so our eyes could adjust. After a moment, she wordlessly shined the beam upward. A never-ending clap of thunder sounded inside me. One reality was replaced by another. I will try to recount what I saw next and what it made me think. We were in an amphitheater with images all around us, of individual animals and groups of animals, bison, horses, reindeer, boars, ibex, and other mammals I can't identify. Stunned, ecstatic, I felt like I almost blacked out. Some animals were walking, others ran or galloped. Every gait was distinct. Some of these animals seemed to hunt. Others were hunted. I think I saw a salmon with a perfectly defined dorsal fin, and nearby, possibly a vertical pig, drawn this way because the wall formation suggested it. I perceived a grouping of animals gathering to drink, rest, eat, play. Every image felt palpable, somatic, centrally rendered, real. The idea that perspective was invented in Florence in 1414 collapsed in an instant. Here, larger mammals are in front of smaller ones who trail behind. Animals at the back of packs are smaller than those in front. There's also what's called reverse perspective, where closer things are rendered smaller than farther things. Elsewhere, an ibex is depicted from behind and over the shoulder, an incredibly sophisticated perspective. One horse is seen from a highly accomplished three-quarters view. Imagery seemed adjusted for curvatures and protrusions of the wall in the same way that Renaissance frescoes adjust for distortions, distance, and odd viewing angles. I saw a bison with one horn curving up, the other curving down, either from battle or birth. Whatever the cause, this was something that had been seen and intentionally rendered. A reindeer evinced shaggy pelage on antlers. Males appeared to sniff females for sign of estrus. Others tilted horns, stomped the ground, charged forward, or assumed postures of sexual submission. In one gripping image, I thought I saw a wolf jumping up and bringing down a horse by the neck. The horse's tail is raised in the exact way they hold their tails when alarmed. Nearby, a bison has three spears in its side. Regardless of whether this and other images depicted hunts or were instructions for how to approach and bring down bison, these painters loved depicting action, movement, gestures, things happening at very particular times. Nothing seemed only imagined. Everything felt observed, studied, thought about, recorded. The psychovisual acuity for an empirical science of animal behavior boggled. So did the desire for color, which came from roots, berries, bark, minerals, clay, red and yellow ochre, and minerals like hematite and manganese oxide, and were mixed with viscera, water, sap, soot, and blood. Moreover, these substances had to be gathered and transported. Every color evinces desire for something more than just graphic outlines. Yet their lines are long, confident, fluid, and drawn from the sort of charcoal sticks you'd find in any fire. The shading I saw on the rear hoof and fetlock of a bison, the first thing that I set eyes on when our guide shined her light in the gallery, never leaves me. It is the punctum, the flashpoint, of the caves for me. For me, all this gave the lie to our long-held egocentric idea that cave paintings are the mystic machinations of master shamans who are portraying some primitive spirit or dream world. Instead, I saw an astonishing artistic naturalism, a stylized realism that accounted for every individual body part, action, dorsal line, and body language, down to what season or even time of day these images were made. Bison chewing their cuds come midday, etc. I venture that when it comes to the best of these paintings, mammals have never been rendered better in the history of our species. These are the paintings of people who looked at mammals for over 30,000 years, far longer than all of recorded history combined. I was seeing visual wisdom, the hard work of looking and taking the time and trouble to make exact renditions of what one watched. Looking at these images, I began to know things we don't know anymore, but still know in our bones. These astounding levels of visual intelligence tell me that had these people wanted to make only symbolic images of their mysticism and magic, they could have. One author of a typically romantic manic book on cave paintings plaintively writes, "We do not know what the images meant to those who made and viewed them. The clap of thunder that sounded for me in the caves was that the world outside and around these peoples was the same as the world that was inside them." Among the chief subjects of these paintings is the inscribing body of the painters and the pleasures taken in making these paintings. To turn this gigantic worldview into an either-or proposition, into demeaning all this as merely hunting magic and dream worlds on the one hand, or going just as far in the other direction, lauding everything here as the masterpieces of a mysterious people, feels false, limiting, more romancing of the world in one easy way or another. It's estimated that about 99.9995% of all Paleolithic art is lost to time. My sparse research suggests that we've discovered about 400 painted cave sites and almost that many open-air sites with art. There's evidence our ancestors didn't just paint rocks, that they drew in vertical river banks, in soft mud, sand, slurries of calcite that coat limestone surfaces, that they engaged in woodworking, body decoration, bark painting, and making of clothing, skin sewing, stone carving, firming clay, carving bone, and the like. I conjecture that art in caves was by far the exception rather than the rule. Enormous, now extinct cave bears, moreover, would have made cave dwelling incredibly risky, if not suicidal. The preservation of cave paintings occurs only under incredibly narrow and lucky circumstances. There must be a very small temperature range, a steady 53.6 degrees Fahrenheit, with no freezing or thawing in 30,000 years, no wind bombardment, plant growth, water inundation, erosion, earthquakes, solar rays, human destruction, and on and on. The first person who stumbled into the Nuo Caves in 1600 instantly inscribed his name and the date next to an ibex. I saw absolute masterpieces of animal portraiture at Nuo, among the greater paintings I've ever viewed. However, I also saw images that were crude, clownish, the scrawls of kids, and maybe even doodles. Indeed, it would be impossible that everything painted here and for thousands of years would be a masterpiece. The good and the bad, however, all evinced things we can instantly relate to as zoological, psychological, frightening, funny, or just fun. I didn't notice any of the famous handprints made by spitting colored pulp around one's hand. Recent computer studies of those handprints, however, suggest that about half of them are women's. Bye-bye, male artist myth. I saw some of the dotting and dashes that many conjecture are celestial observations or calendar notations, but I didn't spy any of the many vulvas and phalluses found at other sites, the kinds of things kids were drawing then, what kids have always drawn when left alone. Either way, this is by and large the art of a young people, as life expectancy is thought to have been 35 years for men and 30 for women. Still, my romantic self ached for what's not here. There are no images of war. Perhaps it didn't exist yet. Or nomadic groups of 50 to 100 people had no need to have war. Given how much these people loved depicting action, I think that they'd have rendered war if it had existed. There are no dogs, because dogs didn't exist yet. But why no pictures of the sun or moon, mountains, trees, or fire, or tools? Why no fruit, insects, lakes, or rivers? No snow or rain? There are depictions of sex, not at Nuo, but alas, no human portraiture. These are the proclaiming shadows cast by cave art for me. In Nuo, art got much bigger for me and became the flying buttress for all the art that follows it, maybe for much that is human. Something seismic hit me in these caves, some capacious cognizance, cryptic, wakeful. Whatever it was, a new type of human existence entered my consciousness, one that I now recognize as at once my own and collective. This was excerpted from a piece that originally appeared in Vulture.com. Back on the health and science page, rethinking fat and cholesterol. For decades, health experts have issued stark warnings that foods high in fat and cholesterol cause heart disease and other illnesses. But new research has determined that these guidelines, which prompted millions to shun red meat and eggs, were not supported by good evidence and were, in fact, in error. In the late 1970s, Americans were encouraged to reduce their fat intake to about 30% of their total daily calories. But after reviewing the research available at the time, a team of British scientists has concluded that there was never any evidence that eating less fat would help reduce the risk of heart disease. When Americans were told to avoid meat, dairy, and fat, they increased their consumption of simple carbohydrates such as sugar, white bread, pasta, and processed foods, the real drivers of obesity, diabetes, and heart disease. The obesity epidemic basically began with the first dietary guidelines, points out Nina Tikoltz, who's written a book on that topic. Meanwhile, the U.S. Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee is no longer classifying cholesterol as a nutrient of concern. The decision, which reverses four decades of government advice, reflects recent research suggesting that eating foods high in cholesterol does not significantly raise cholesterol levels in blood or increase the risk of heart disease. Genetics, it turns out, has a much greater effect on cholesterol levels than diet. We got the dietary guidelines wrong, Dr. Stephen Nissen of the Cleveland Clinic tells USA Today. They've been wrong for decades. Meditation delays aging. Meditation doesn't just improve mental and physical health in the present. It also slows the aging process and can help meditators stay mentally sharp into old age, a new study has found. Once people reach their mid to late 20s, their brains begin to lose volume and weight, which can eventually result in the loss of some functional ability. But when researchers from UCLA compared brain scans of 50 people who meditated for at least 4 years with scans of 50 people who didn't, they found that those who engaged in the practice had smaller reductions in gray matter, the neuron-containing tissue responsible for processing information. What we expected was to see this in just a few small regions, Dr. Florian Kuth, the study's co-author, tells HuffingtonPost.com. But what we saw was almost the entire brain. That was a big surprise. The findings do not prove causality. Meditators may have other healthy habits that contribute to brain health. But the researchers said that meditation would appear to be a powerful tool for reducing the risks of age-related cognitive disease and neurodegenerative disorders, such as Alzheimer's disease. On the Talking Points page, Walker. Can a college dropout become president? Does the U.S. president need a college degree? Said Albert R. Hunt in BloombergView.com. That's the question everybody's been asking since it emerged that GOP presidential contender Scott Walker is a college dropout, having left Marquette University for a job in 1990 without the necessary credits to graduate. If elected in 2016, the Wisconsin governor would be the first president since 1953 not to hold a bachelor's degree, prompting former Vermont Governor Howard Dean, a Yale graduate, to question whether Walker is qualified for one of the toughest jobs on the planet. How well educated is this guy, said Dean. It's a question that may resonate with the 40% of American voters who did graduate from college, and probably expect the same of anyone seeking the presidency. But many highly successful Americans did not have college diplomas, including Bill Gates, the late Steve Jobs, and Abraham Lincoln. So Walker got a D-minus in French, said Megan McArdle, also in BloombergView.com. Who cares? The 47-year-old has plenty of real-life credentials to prove he's qualified for the White House, such as his two successive terms as the Republican governor of a blue state. That kind of executive experience matters far more than a piece of paper that America's Mandarin class now thinks is the basic credential for being a worthy, capable person. Life experience certainly counts, but Walker's decision to drop out isn't just about his level of education, said Laura Brown in USNews.com. It's about his character. What does it say about the governor that he was just 34 credits short of his degree and walked away? I wouldn't advise Democrats to attack Walker on these grounds, said Paul Brandis in TheWeek.com. If anything, blue-collar voters, the kind the Democratic Party has been hemorrhaging, might like Walker not in spite of the fact that he didn't finish college, but because of it. The governor's political rise is a real up-by-your-bootstrap story, and that signals true character to the 142 million voters in this country who don't have a diploma themselves. As for all the Ivy League snobs like Dean who disagree, said Ryan Gerdusky in the WashingtonTimes.com, I advise them to consider the last diplomaless president, Harry Truman, who most historians suggest was a far better president than some with expensive credentials from our elite colleges and universities. And some short notes as we wind down the hour. More teenagers are now trying e-cigarettes than tobacco, according to a new University of Michigan survey. Among 16-year-olds, 16.2% had used an e-cigarette in the previous month, while only 7% said they had smoked a tobacco cigarette. The Catholic Church is losing ground in Latin America. From 1990 to 1960, 90% of the region's residents identified as Catholics. But in the last 50 years, that figure has fallen to 69%, according to the Pew Research Center. Nearly one in five Latin Americans now consider themselves Protestant. Many museums are banning visitors from using so-called selfie sticks, which hold a smartphone or camera a few feet from the body. Officials fear the extended sticks will accidentally damage exhibits or other guests. On the poll watch, 54% of Americans want Congress to approve President Obama's request for authorization to use military force against ISIS. 66% support deploying U.S. ground troops in that fight, including 26% who want to send a large force and 40% who favor limited ground operations. 26% oppose any use of ground forces. And a quote to finish up. At some point in life, the world's beauty becomes enough. You don't need a photograph, paint, or even remember it. It is enough. From Toni Morrison. We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138. So long until next time.